You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
We could actually analyze the noises of the submarines, and we could not only tell his direction and where he was going, but how fast he was going. We could tell whether it was a Whiskey or a Foxtrot or a Romeo. I think you saw that in Hunt for Red October.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Colonel Terry Chester spent a good portion of his Royal Canadian Air Force career hunting for Soviet submarines in both the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. He was instrumental in the design criteria for sub-hunting capabilities when Canada procured the then-new Aurora for anti-submarine hunting in the early 1980s. Terry has some great stories to tell regarding sub-hunting tactics as well as Canadian participation in NATO exercises. As the podcast gets more popular, our costs of hosting and running the podcast increase. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, a few dollars, pounds or rubles a month help keep us on the air. Head over to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Support the Podcast menu option to learn more. Thank you so much to all our fans that are supporting us. It is really appreciated. Now back to today's episode, where we start with Terry telling us about his early career.
I joined the RCAF in 1964, right out of high school, actually. I went down to a recruiting center, and they told me that they would pay my way through university. And so I said, well, I'll take that. So I signed up. I graduated from university under the regular officer training plan in 68, and was posted to Summerside, Prince Edward Island, to fly on the Argus aircraft. The Argus was a four-engine torpedo-carrying anti-submarine aircraft, a derivative of the Bristol Britannia, actually. Canada took that Bristol Britannia, made it into a couple of airplanes. One was a Yukon, which we put turboprops on. It was a transport aircraft. And the other one was the Argus, which they put...
Okay. The Bristol Britannia, was that an airliner?
Yes, it was. It was a British airliner, a very unique one, free-floating control systems. And for those that in the aviation business would understand, a very difficult aircraft to fly precisely because the control systems were not linked directly to the control column. They went through a system of servo tabs. So you moved a servo tab, and that servo tab then moved the control column moved the control surface in the direction you wanted. So it was very loose, very easily maintainable. There weren't any large hydraulic systems. And in any event, the aircraft was always a handful. So when I got posted off to Summerside, I actually was a navigator radio officer for 3 years. I flew around in the back of this aircraft, operating all the anti-submarine warfare systems and the radios, etc. And then I decided I wanted a seat with a window. So I asked to cross train to pilot, and I already had my private pilot's license. And so unbelievably, they said, yes, okay, fine. So they sent me off pilot training. And when I got my wings in Cold Lake, Alberta, they immediately posted me right back to the Argus. And so I ended up moving up to the cockpit and flying it. And I spent the next 10 years flying and instructing down in Summerside and Greenwood, Nova Scotia, on the Argus aircraft. I traveled to pretty much every country in the free world. I never did get to the Soviet Union, but the Argus, being a long-range patrol bomber, it traveled extensively. So I was everywhere from Australia all the way up through Iceland and Norway and Denmark and et cetera, all through Europe. Spent a lot of time in the UK, flying out of the UK's bases up in Prestwick and down in St. Maugham in the UK, where you guys flew the Nimrods from, and working with the Americans and flying out of U.S. Navy bases all the way up to Adak, Alaska, and out of Thule, Greenland, didn't get much down into Africa, although we were into the Azores and that sort of stuff. But our job was to patrol the North Atlantic and make sure that we had a good handle on where the Soviets, the Russians, were putting their submarines. So that was our expertise. All sort of came... Canada's role in ASW, we were recognized as one of the best in ASW. Ian, if I bounce into an acronym that you don't understand or that you may not know, just stop me. ASW, of course, anti-submarine warfare. In 1962, actually, before I even started, I didn't start flying, as I said, till later. Canada's ASW force was brought to the fore. You may remember back in 62 was a Cuban Missile Crisis. And the Americans blockaded the Russian submarines and ships from sending missiles to Cuba. And Canada was involved in that. And our Argus aircraft was out over the oceans, monitoring the Russian submarines, first as they came down through the GI-UK gap. That's a Greenland-Iceland-UK gap, that spot of water in there north of Scotland, where all Russian submarines that want to enter the Atlantic have to come through that gap. And it's a choke point. And so we based out of Iceland, Reykjavik in Iceland, and also out of Bodø in Norway, and of course out of the UK, Scotland, and we were helping to monitor the Russians as they came through, and then as they transited down through the Atlantic, we wanted them to know that we were there, and we were armed with depth bombs and torpedoes. And if someone had pushed the button and said, we need you to sink that submarine, we were quite prepared to do it. So it was an interesting time, but Canada honed its ASW skills then. We were, as I said, we were recognized as one of the best in the world. And the Argus aircraft was equipped with all of the latest sensors. We had active and passive sensors, and I'll go through those in a bit. But we obviously had the old World War II anti-submarine sensors, the radars, etc. But we had also got some new quieter, more passive sensors with which we tracked these submarines. Now the Russian submarines they had hundreds and hundreds of these submarines. At that time, during the 60s and 70s, it was their conventional fleet. They were snorkeling submarine, diesel electrics is what they were. They had diesel engines that charged up electric batteries. We had NATO code names for them all, the Whiskey, the Zulu, the Golf, the Romeo, the Foxtrot. All of those types of submarines.
I've actually been on a Foxtrot, strangely.
Wow.
There's one in the UK moored on the River Medway. that used to be a museum ship, and the guy there is trying to find a mooring for it, and it looks like the crew got off it just yesterday. It's a fascinating boat, and it's really interesting hearing you talk about this, because it does sort of bring it more to life, having been on one of these submarines.
Absolutely. And of course, they had, can you imagine, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Das Boot, but where these guys are in a submarine under the water. But I got to tell you, I'm slightly claustrophobic, and I would not want to be in any one of these boats.
I have seen that film, and I do vividly remember that sequence where I think they're trying to get through the Straits of Gibraltar.
Yes.
And they get depth charge. So the depth charges you had, were they sort of just like a World War II depth charge?
It was the Mark 54. It was a depth bomb. I think it was about 100 pounds of TNT. We carried 16 of them in our bomb bays. We had big bomb bays. And we would drop them in a stick of eight at a 30-degree angle to the MLA of the submarine, the main line of approach to submarine. So we would fly at 100 feet over the water, 100 feet. Now, our wingspan, you've got to remember, in the Argus was 150 feet. So here we are at 100 feet down low level, bomb bays open, coming in on the submarine, and we would fly across him at 30 degrees and drop and plant it. So we would drop four depth bombs on one side of him and four on the other, and then they were fused so that they would explode from the outside in, and so they would cause a concussion and break the submarine in half. Now, they exploded somewhere between 100 and 200 feet below the surface. They had a little propeller on the tail that had to spin so many times before the bomb was armed. It was a real trick to be able to drop these precisely across the submarine. Of course, the submarine was in the process. He saw you coming, right? So he's in the process of doing a crash dive. The most effective time to attack the submarine, obviously, when he's on the surface or when he's snorkeling. And so you would you'd catch him either on radar or visually. With the Mark One eyeball, we used to call it, which was actually our best sensor, and then scoot in, drop down as low as you could. If you could, you could come from up sun, you know, just like the Hun and the Sun, and then you'd drop your depth bombs on him. Then, of course, as he's you would assume that you didn't kill him, that he was still trying to get away. So then you would establish a MAD trapping pattern around him. And now MAD, magnetic anomaly detector, on the tail of the Argus, as there is in the Nimrod and the Atlantique and all ASW aircraft, there's a magnetic sensor right out on the tip of the tail. The reason it's out there is to keep it clear of aircraft electronics. Well, that detects large bodies of metal under the water.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And so we would fly low level again, 200 feet. And we would do a trapping circle around where we saw his swirl go down, where his last known point was, and about a 2,000-yard circle, I think. And we would fly this, waiting for him to broach the circle. And our guys in the back are monitoring the equipment. And as soon as they saw a large deflection on their needles, then we knew we had flown over him. So we would drop a smoke marker in the water. And then we knew where he was when he went down, and we knew where he was when we got the MAD mark. So then we would just draw a line, and then we would fly down that line again with the MAD on again. And if we got another MAD mark, then we would drop a couple of torpedoes. And we also had torpedoes in the bomb bay, Mark 44s, I think. Yeah, Mark 44s. We would drop a couple of those on his where we projected he was. We would actually drop them on the next med mark, is what it was called, and then listen. We also dropped at that time, we would drop listening devices, sonobuoys, into the water to listen for his noise, for the noise. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the big vulnerabilities of a submarine is its noise. They make noise, a lot of noise. Their propellers make noise, their motors, their auxiliaries, they all make noise. And that noise, water is a great medium for transmitting noise. And so we would put listening devices, sonobuoys, into the water to listen for him. And we got so sophisticated later on with listening to that, we could actually analyze the noises of the submarines in some of our later equipment. And we could not only tell his direction and where he was going, but how fast he was going. We could even identify the type of submarine it was by the engine noise. We could tell whether it was a Whiskey or a Foxtrot or a Romeo just by the engine noises and noise that the submarine was making. I think you saw that in Hunt for Red October and all those guys. Those acoustics guys, we called them, they were magic. And they, Jonesy, they could listen to the sound the submarine was making, and they could tell you that the guy had a chip in his blade or that the turbine was running slightly off speed, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was...
I just want to ask you a couple of questions on some of the stuff that you've just mentioned there.
Yeah.
That you mentioned dropping the torpedoes. Did they have a homing mechanism of any kind?
Absolutely. Yeah. They would drop in the water. We usually tried to drop them ahead of the submarine, and they would circle. They would do a right or left turn. I don't forget which it is. And they would circle back and they would ping. They had their own little sonar in them. And so they would ping out. And when they got acquired the target, they would home in on the target and explode on, I think it was a proximity fuse, or maybe it was on impact. They would explode when they hit the submarine. Absolutely. They were active torpedoes, and the submarine knew they were in the water. He could hear them as they were trying to acquire him. And he was obviously trying to get out, wriggle out of that with the torpedoes. Now he had noisemakers he could put in the water, and they had ways of putting a knuckle in the water, they called it, where they would turn rapidly, create a large air bubble, which they hoped the torpedo would home on. But of course now the Americans and the Russians have much, much more sophisticated torpedoes, wake homing torpedoes, they call them, et cetera, et cetera. So but that was fairly rudimentary, and we would drop at least two, and then if we were really in a hurry and whatever, and we didn't see it, we'd drop two more. I mean, we were trained that it was very unusual, that you would ever acquire this guy, and when you got him, you didn't want to let him go. Our objective was to fill him full of water, we were motivated to do that. The crews that we were had, we had crews of about 17 to 20 people that worked as a team. If I have more, I'd like to talk to you about another hunting tactic that we use that really brought the teamwork together. It was called Julie. Julie was a very interesting way of locating a submarine under the water. It was explosive echo ranging is what it was. So when the submarine went down, the navigator, a tactical navigator back, would direct the pilot over the spot, and they would drop some sonobuoys, those listening devices. And when we dropped the sonobuoy, we would drop a small explosive charge with it that would detonate when the hydrophone from the sonobuoy was at depth. And that would send out a little explosion of the water. And mm-hmm. we would be listening to that. And then we would hear if there was a return echo. And when we got the echo, the guys had these paper charts. They could actually measure the time and we convert, obviously, the time into distance around that sonoboy. So we got an echo off a sonoboy. So we knew that if we got an echo, that the submarine was, let's just say, 1,000 yards from that sonoboy, anywhere on that circle. So then we would drop another sonoboy with a charge. And if we got another echo, then we could, then we'd have 2 points. And the nav would be plotting this on his chart at the back. And then one more to for triangulation. And then we had a fairly good idea within 200 or 300 yards of where that submarine was. And then we could go over there with the MAD to verify that. And then once we got a MAD contact, the MAD told us within about 200 yards where he was. It was very accurate. When we got a MAD mark, we knew that that's exactly where it was. And we could actually attack off MAD and drop our. So, but that Julie sequence required extreme crew coordination. We had a nose observer in the glass or the plexiglass nose of the Argus. He had a visual plot and he said, Sonoboy 10 is over there. There's a smoke, a turn right pilot. The pilots were driving the aircraft. The nav was telling him what sonoboy to go over on what heading and on what altitude. Then he would call for a drop of a particular channel sonoboy, and the guy in the ordnance guy in the back would have to drop it out when he was told, along with a smoke or a charge. And it was like a ballet. When a crew was doing Julie and the instructions were coming and they were yanking and banking. Remember, you're 200 to 300 feet above the ocean. And they also did this at night where there was a significant chance of disorientation, especially on a clear night. There's a sad story. We did lose an Argus back in about 64 off Puerto Rico that was doing a night ASW exercise and actually crashed into the water. And they believe that the pilots got severely disoriented, low level, and you had the stars up in the sky, a black, black sea and sky, and then you had the lights of the sonoboys in the ocean. And they believe he might have been disoriented at 300 feet or so and just turned into the water. But the crew were worked up, we were motivated, and we wanted to find that submarine. Later on, then, we got another system called Jezebel. And Jezebel was another way of analyzing the acoustic signature of the submarine. But the beauty of Jezebel was that it was passive. That is, the submarine didn't know you were there. We dropped these sonoboys in and we just listened. And you could pick up the signature of the submarine. And like I said, we could analyze it. And then we would drop little barriers where we thought he was going of these sonoboys and then monitor the barrier for this guy to pass it. And then we'd put another couple of barriers. The submarine, not knowing you're there, he's not going to change course or anything. And we could track this guy for hours, him being completely unaware that we're tracking him. And so that even applied when the Russians went for nuclear submarines. Nuclear submarines under the water are also extremely noisy. They're a lot quieter these days. But we had some great times for hours and hours just tracking. And then when we went off station, we would actually hand over our contact to the guy relieving us and say, "Here he is. He's on this sonoboy here. Have a nice day," and off we go home. So it was an exciting time for us all. We had a defined enemy, and we knew how to find him, and if necessary, we knew what we had to do to neutralize him. They were heady days for us all because we had good equipment. We had very, very good people, and we had a mission. We felt very, very proud of what we were doing and our capabilities to help deter this threat. And I mentioned to you before how how we were motivated to do that, our bosses and our political leaders did a great job of demonizing these people, telling us that they were going to kill our wives and children in their beds, and that it was our job to get out there and make sure they didn't. And so we would go on these 16 to 18 hour patrols, and that's how long they were. We'd take off at sometimes 3-4 in the morning, you know, and recover the next night after having flown out 1,000 miles to sea, done a 4 or 5, a 6 hour patrol, and then flown home. We felt motivated and good about what we did because we thought we were making a difference.
And how did you deal with that length of time in the air? I mean, you know, was boredom come into it?
Well, boredom is certainly boredom. We always took a good book. In those days, you know, that people didn't have a cell phone to play video games and stuff. You took a good book, but there was a routine. You generally worked, like for in the cockpit, you would go up and you would go into the right seat for 2 hours, and then you would get out, get a 10-minute break, stretch your legs, get a cup of coffee, whatever. Then you go into the left seat for 2 hours, and then you come out, and then you'd be off for 2 hours. So we had a crew of 3 pilots, and so you'd rotate. So while you were off, we had 4 bunk beds in the aircraft, a full kitchen where we would actually cook steak dinners. And some of the you always had a good cook on the crew who would whip up fantastic gourmet meals and breakfasts and stuff. Because generally, when you got airborne, excuse me, you hadn't had breakfast, so you would whip up a breakfast. And then there was always something to do. Some of the equipment, you know, in the back maybe need a bit of tweaking or peaking. So you'd be pulling boxes out and fixing them, or getting the sauna boys ready for when you got on station. Or, you know what, we also had a lot of tests and exams. We were checked all the time. As a pilot, I had 3 check rides a year, instrument check ride, proficiency handling check ride, on and on. So you'd be studying up for your exams. And so you'd have the AOIs, the aircraft operating instructions. You'd have those out. You'd be reading. And another thing that the crews did is because we all depended on each other, we'd be asking each other questions. And if there was a quiet moment in transit or stuff, the captain, the crew commander, whose job it was to oversee all training, would be asking the young second officer questions or what ifs. OK, we're here and whatever. It would be part of his job to train. So we were never bored. I must admit, you know, there were times when I wish I was home in my nice warm bed, but we were out there. So I was either sleeping or eating or reading or doing my job. It was supposed to be the equivalent of 2 full crews on board, but in fact, it was just 1 big crew, and we rotated through the position. The navs rotated between routine nav, tac nav, scribe, etc. The radio officers, equipment operators, would rotate between the ASW, which is the position in the back, the sauna boy ordnance, or he'd be running the ESM, electronic surveillance measures, or he'd be running the radar, or he'd be on acoustics, or he'd be up on the radio. Now, the radio, the HF radio, was obviously our main piece of that's how we communicated on HF. And interestingly, in those days, it was single sideband Morse code in the 60s. So when I first trained as a navigator radio officer, I had to learn Morse code, and I could send and receive Morse code at about 35 or 40 words a minute, just like an old teletype operator. Because when you're out in the middle of the ocean or way up north or whatever, HF is really unreliable. But Morse code can always get through. So and we'd be sending position reports. We send a position report when we're out every hour, just in case something happened and we ended up in the water. If they didn't talk to us for 2 or 3 hours, then they knew where we were 2 or 3 hours ago. And so that's where the search and rescue would go.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Right, and I presume you'd have to encode that before you send it.
Absolutely. We had all these old codes. They were paper codes. And so we would have to take it laboriously, you know, go across the top and down the side. So the letter A is really a Q, you know, and we code it all up. And it was the job of the radio officer to bring the codes with him and just sort of top secret codes and whatever. He would be the only guy that was allowed to look at them. And so when the nav would say, okay, it's time to send the hourly message, he would give it on a piece of paper, and the radio officer would code it up and then send it out to base. And then of course base had the same set of codes for the day. They would decode it. The codes were only good for 24 hours. They would have our position. So later on, single sideband radio got better, and we could talk, use voice, but still all coded. And then much later, it's just towards the end of the life of the Argus, we started getting radios where we could insert a coded card, and we had a teletype, so we could actually type the message out. It would be coded up and it would go out just like the German submarines did with Enigma, you know. But it took us until almost 1980 to catch up to that. But that was later on, and the Morse key kind of went by the side. But even to this day, some 50 years later, I can still send and receive Morse code. It was drilled into me so much that it was one of those things you never forget. I'm probably not as fast as I used to be, but the codes and security were something. Quite often we will go out on what's called a covert mission. In other words, we didn't want them to know that we knew where they were, playing the big games. One of the things we did. The Americans had a really great system called SOSUS, Sound Underwater Surveillance System, something like that. And they had, they still may have it, but I know it's not secret anymore. We were not allowed to talk about it in public, but it's been in Reader's Digest, so I'm sure I can talk about it.
Oh, well, you're fine then.
In Argentia, Newfoundland, there was a base there. And also down through the States. And I believe there are a couple up off of Norway and Denmark, and certainly in the UK, where they had these underwater listening devices. They're permanently there, connected by a long chain. And these would pick up the sounds of a submarine coming by, and they would transmit that position to us. And then we would go out and verify that with our sonobuoys. Well, because of the secrecy of this all, when we took off, just like in World War II, when the Lancaster bombers were heading over, we would get a green light from the tower, literally, and take off. Wouldn't talk to anybody. Would go due regard out over the ocean, low level, not send any position reports, nothing. And we'd be out there for like 10 to 12 hours, all by ourselves, no lights, no nothing, secretly out there. Listening and monitoring, and then of course we come back with all the tapes and all the data and put that into the system, and the intelligence system would then update all of their data with that. So those were times we didn't tell anybody where we were going. We were like secret squirrels, you know, just churning about out there over the ocean. It was kind of exciting, you know. We kind of felt close. Here we are, sneaking about over the ocean. Of course, there's no one else is stupid enough to be flying around at 2,000 or 3,000 feet over the Atlantic. So we weren't worried about running into anybody because all the airliner traffic was all up at 30,000 feet, where we couldn't go. Remember, we were just radial engines. We weren't pressurized. We had very occasionally, the little anecdotes, we would talk to we called them the aluminum overcast, the aircraft up there. We'd hear them talking, speedbird 526, you know, flight level 600, you know, and we'd call back and say, hey, speedbird, we're at 600 as well. I said, hey, really? Well, yes, 600 feet. We would have some great times. Every once in a while, those old Wright 3350s would not work well. They were air-cooled cylinders, and if the spark plugs didn't work in one of the cylinders, they had 18 cylinders on each engine, and if the spark plugs went out, the cylinder would cool down and it would crack. So we had to shut that engine down. So one day I lost an engine. I had a cylinder. My flight engineer, who handled all the engines, said, we've got to shut down number one. We've got a dead pot, which is a cylinder. So we shut it down and we returned home. Well, we tried to call in via HF radio to tell them we were coming home with a dead engine, and we couldn't get through. So we went to the aluminum overcast, VHF 121.5, and said, would you relay this message, please, to Halifax Military? We're coming home with a dead cylinder. And the guy said, I think it was Air Canada, or was it? Certainly, we'll relay that. So they relayed it over their net. Then I heard another guy on the net say, Air Canada 524, this is Boeing, the British Airways. So that, yes, what is that? What's a cylinder? You know, we kind of felt, okay, fine, whatever. The old Arcus aircraft, she brought me home. I have about 6,000 hours flying that aircraft. She brought me home many, many times on three. She could fly on two and even one at very low weights. But it was quite routine, actually, after a while to do three engine landings. We were very, very good at it. And my old flight engineer would say, if we were meant to land on four engines, we'd have five. Because they were a wonderful engine, about 3,300 horsepower. We got out of that. Or was it? Yeah, 3,350 or something like that. 3,700 horsepower out of a 3,350 cubic inch engine. So we were actually getting a horsepower, more than one horsepower for every cubic inch. Anti-detonant injection, which is an ethylene glycol mixture we used to inject into the cylinders on takeoff to give us more horsepower. It cooled the cylinder down. And we could drive that baby cheap, noisy. It converted 115, 145 into noise and very little forward movement. But it was a wonderful old airplane with all the sensors, a wonderful crew, motivated. We thoroughly enjoyed flying it all through the 70s, and then of course at the end of the 70s, it was at the end of its useful life, and we got ourselves a new airplane, still engaged in the Cold War, and I was involved in that. I was instructing on the Argus then in Greenwood, and I got involved in the introduction of the new aircraft. Was new then, the CP-140 Aurora, which was an American P-3 with the guts of an S-3 Viking. The S-3 Viking is a carrier-borne ASW aircraft, very swept-up avionics. Well, Canada took the P-3, worked with Lockheed, and we put the interior and the sensors from a Viking inside this P3, and we called it the CP-140. Right. And we bought 18 of them, and they were then we were back on top of we were kings in the ASW world again, because now we had a new airplane, new capabilities, and I have to tell you, all my friends in the USN were green jealous because we were able to do things like single buoy Doppler tracking of Soviet nukes. We were always being called by the Americans to deploy to places like Bermuda, the Azores, etc., to help them locate difficult targets. And I can remember one time there was a Delta submarine, which is a pretty swept up ballistic missile submarine the Soviets have, that was giving them trouble down south of the Azores. And we deployed an Aurora there, and I was with them. We must have been there a month because we will go out and find this guy, track him for a while, hand him over to the Americans. They would lose him. Then we'd have to go out and find him again and hand him over to the Americans, and they would lose him because we had a really good team of expert. Our acousticians were officers, trained officers, university degree officers, who were at the top of their game. And they could manipulate their equipment and find needles in haystacks and stuff. So we were on top of our game with the Aurora once again. The Auroras are still with us. I was lucky enough to go down to Burbank help to bring some of those aircraft back home, and then help to set up the training unit in Greenwood, where I taught other people how to fly this airplane. And it was like going from a Model T Ford to a Maserati. I mean, we were kids in a candy store with this brand new airplane. We thought we were God's answer to aviation. We had the world by the ass, and we were running downhill, I believe the expression is.
Well, it sounds like the USN thought you were, God's gift to ASW anyway, if you were finding these nuclear subs.
Indeed. And we were helping them out. And we actually, the Americans were flying with us. They would ask to come on board. This basically was an American airplane, right? I mean, we just happened to buy it. But yeah, we were so good at it that the Americans would come and they say, how do you do that? What are you doing here? And here's another little insight. The U.S. Navy, who jealously guard any secrets about their submarines, were not very happy with us because we were picking up data and stuff that they wouldn't even tell the U.S. Navy P3 fleet. And we were picking up and recording all this information. We would say, we found this Los Angeles class submarine. He's at this position and that position. And they would come back and say, no, he wasn't there. No, you're mistaken. He wasn't there. And so then they started having guys fly with us to find out what we were finding out and telling us, I'm sorry, that's no foreign information. I mean, no non-US types are allowed to see that information. And so we'd say, hey, well, look, you guys are putting it out there. We're going to find it.
Well, that's all we had time for, but we do have a second episode coming up with some more great stories from Terry's career. Do visit the show notes at coldwarconversations.com, where there's details of Vintage Wings, a collection of historically significant aircraft that Terry has worked on, as well as the Royal Canada Air Force Association, of which Terry was a national president. If you like what you are listening to, you can really help us by leaving reviews on iTunes or with your favorite podcast provider. It really helps raise our profile and get great guests like Terry onto the show. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where our guests and listeners like yourselves continue the Cold War conversation. Just go to coldwarconversations.com and click on the Join the Conversation option. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.